Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We'll see what happens. It's going to be a bad problem for Iran if something happens, I can tell you that. They're not going to be happy. They are not going to be happy people. Okay? You can figure it out yourself. They know what I mean by it.
The Pentagon's reportedly drawn up a plan to send as many as 120,000 troops to the Middle East if President Trump decides to take military action against Iran. Meanwhile, the European Union is urging the U.S. to show maximum restraint as fears grow of a new U.S. war in the Middle East. We'll speak to former Iranian ambassador Sayed Hossein Mousavian. Then we speak to the acclaimed playwright, author, and activist, Eve Ensler.
When I was a child, from the time I was five until I left home, first my father sexually abused me, and then he violently abused me, almost to the point of murder a couple of times. He died 31 years ago, but before he died, and ever since he died, I've been waiting for an apology. And I finally decided that I needed to write the apology. And write the words and say the words and hear the words that I needed in order to get free.
Eve Ensler will talk about her new book, The Apology. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As tensions continue to mount between the United States and Iran, the New York Times reports the Pentagon's drawn up a plan to send as many as 120,000 troops to the Middle East if President Trump decides to take military action against Iran. The U.S. recently deployed a carrier strike group and a bomber task force to the region, claiming there was a credible threat by Iranian regime forces. Meanwhile, the European Union's urging the Trump administration to show maximum restraint following a meeting Monday between Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and European Union diplomats in Brussels. Iran has announced it'll stop complying with parts of the landmark 2015 nuclear deal if other signatories of the deal do not take action to shield Iran's oil and banking sectors from U.S. sanctions. We'll have more on Iran after headlines. President Trump welcomed Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán to the White House Monday. The far-right nationalist leader is known for his hardline anti-immigrant policies and rolling back democratic institutions and checks on his power. This is Orbán and Trump speaking from the Oval Office.
We have some similar approaches, and I would like to express that we are proud to stand together with the United States on fighting against illegal migration, on terrorism, and to protect and help the Christian communities all around the world.
I know he's a tough man, but he's a respected man, and he's done the right thing, according to many people, on immigration. And you look at some of the problems that they have in Europe that are tremendous, because they've done it a different way than the prime minister.
Trump's predecessors, Presidents Obama and George W. Bush, declined to host Orbán over concerns about his leadership. Orbán has closed down Hungary's southern border, building a razor wire fence to keep out refugees, many of them from Syria, and deported refugees already in the country. China announced Monday plans to raise tariffs on $60 billion worth of U.S. goods starting June 1st. The announcement came after the two nations failed to reach a deal as trade negotiations closed last Friday, and as President Trump followed through on his threat to hike tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports. Trump also says he plans to raise tariffs on the $325 billion worth of remaining Chinese imports. The stock market tumbled following the news, with the Dow dropping over 600 points Monday. Trump told reporters Monday he would use some of the expected tariff revenue to help subsidize farmers, saying they can sell for less and make as much money until it's straightened out. Our farmers will be happy, Trump said. Economists and Trump's own economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, have refuted Trump's claims that China will bear the economic brunt of the increased tariffs, saying consumers will bear it in the United States. In the Philippines, early results from Monday's midterm elections indicate strong-arm President Rodrigo Duterte has further consolidated his power as his allies lead in races across the Philippines. The results could tilt the government's makeup in his favor, removing political barriers to some of his more draconian proposals. The president's oldest daughter, Sara Duterte, has handily re-elected as mayor of Davao City, while most of the senatorial candidates she supported have also won their races. She is seen by many as next in line running to head the Philippines, according to independent Filipino news site Rappler. An election watchdog reported incidents of violence, machine malfunctions, and voter disenfranchisement throughout the day. In related news, Maria Ressa, the award-winning editor and founder of Rappler, was arraigned today on one count of cyber libel. Ressa, who's been a vocal critic of President Duterte and his drug war, has been systematically targeted for her reporting. Her lawyers say the case may head to the Supreme Court. To see her interviews on Democracy Now!, go to democracynow.org. In Sudan, at least six protesters and a member of security forces were killed when security and paramilitary forces opened fire on crowds outside military headquarters in the capital, Khartoum, Monday. Dozens more were injured. Earlier in the day, the Transitional Military Council said they reached an agreement with protest leaders on a transitional power structure. Demonstrators have been demanding a transfer from military to civilian rule. This is protester Rasha Ali.
We will not accept being treated like we have been treated by the previous and current regimes, whether Bashir or others. We have been treated in ways that are unacceptable by anyone. This scenario will not be repeated.
Also on Monday, deposed President Omar al-Bashir was charged in the killing of protesters during the popular uprising, which led to his overthrow last month. One of the deaths being investigated is that of a doctor who was shot dead while assisting injured protesters. In Sri Lanka, a Muslim man was killed Monday in northwestern province as ongoing violence and attacks against Muslim targets has led authorities to impose an indefinite curfew in the region. A nationwide curfew in the rest of Sri Lanka has been relaxed. A number of Muslim-owned businesses, homes and places of worship have been vandalized after 2 days of rioting in the northern province as Muslims celebrate the holy month of Ramadan. In response, Sri Lanka also again blocked popular social media networks and apps they say were responsible for the violent acts, including Facebook and WhatsApp. Tensions in Sri Lanka have been on the rise since last month's Easter suicide bomb massacre, which killed at least 257 people in churches and hotels. Back in the United States, the Supreme Court ruled Monday consumers can sue Apple for exercising a monopoly over the apps market. The court, however, did not determine whether or not Apple does, in fact, have a monopoly on the market, and a class action lawsuit will likely now move ahead in lower courts. Apple charges a 30% sales commission to app developers while excluding them from making sales outside their app store. Meanwhile, Apple has its own set of competing services like Apple News Plus and an upcoming streaming service. Justice Brett Kavanaugh joined the liberal justices in its 5-4 ruling. In more technology news, WhatsApp urged its 1.5 billion users to update their apps after it was revealed hackers found a way to remotely install surveillance software on smartphones and other personal devices via the popular messaging app. The attack was reportedly orchestrated by Israeli security firm NSO Group. NSO has been implicated in surveillance efforts on behalf of the Saudi and Mexican governments. The Committee to Protect Journalists warned that journalists, lawyers, activists, and human rights defenders were the most likely targets of the attack. WhatsApp is owned by Facebook. The New York Times is reporting Attorney General William Barr has assigned federal prosecutor John Durham in Connecticut to look into the origins of the FBI's investigation into possible ties between the Trump campaign and Russian interference in the 2016 election. Barr has referred to the FBI's court-authorized activities as spying during congressional testimony, raising alarm among Democrats who've accused Barr of acting as Trump's personal attorney in the wake of his handling of the Mueller report. Two other investigations into the Russia probe are ongoing. In Oakland, California, Monsanto has been ordered to pay its highest damages yet in the third lawsuit over the popular weed killer Roundup. A jury has ordered Monsanto, which is owned by the German pharmaceutical giant Bayer, to pay more than $2 billion in punitive damages to Alva and Alberta Pilliod, a couple who were both diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma cancer after using Roundup on their properties for over 30 years. The main ingredient in the herbicide is glyphosate and is said to cause cancer. Attorneys for the plaintiffs estimate there are tens of thousands of similar cases against Roundup pending in courts around the United States. This is attorney Brent Wisner speaking after the verdict was announced.
Monsanto keeps denying that it causes cancer, and these two fine people here are casualties of that deception. This is going to continue until Monsanto and now Bayer takes responsibility for its product. People are dying. People are getting sick. And they have no idea that it's being caused by Roundup.
Earlier this month, the EPA said glyphosate is not carcinogenic. However, other scientific studies and the World Health Organization have found that human exposure can, in fact, lead to cancer. In more environmental news, carbon levels in the atmosphere registered 415 parts per million over the weekend, a level that has not been seen in over 3 million years. The reading was observed at an observatory in Hawaii and is the latest indicator of the fast-growing threat of atmospheric carbon concentration driving climate change. Meteorologist Eric Holthaus tweeted, "Not just in recorded history, not just since the invention of agriculture 10,000 years ago, since before modern humans existed millions of years ago, we don't know a planet like this," he said. In New York City, a disciplinary hearing is underway for a white police officer who killed unarmed African-American Eric Garner in 2014 by putting him in a chokehold and refusing to let go, even as Garner repeatedly gasped, "I can't breathe," 11 times. Officer Daniel Pantaleo never faced criminal prosecution after a grand jury decided not to indict him. He's remained on the police force but could lose his job if found guilty of violating NYPD procedures, which bans the use of chokeholds. Montana Governor Steve Bullock is the latest Democrat to enter the crowded field for the 2020 presidential nomination. Bullock is hoping his electoral success in a red state can help boost his appeal among primary voters who now have nearly two dozen candidates to consider. He previously served as Montana's attorney general. In his announcement video, Bullock vowed to fight corruption in D.C. and put an end to big money in political campaigns. Although more of a centrist than many of his fellow contenders, Bullock has pushed progressive policies like expanding Medicaid and protecting public lands in Montana. Governor Bullock came under fire earlier this year after it was revealed he failed to disclose that a former employee was fired for sexual harassment after the employee was hired by New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. And in Washington, D.C., four activists remain in the Venezuelan embassy after police raided the building Monday night. Activists with Code Pink, Answer Coalition, and other groups have been occupying the building since late April at the invitation of Venezuela's government in order to prevent it being taken over by Venezuela's U.S.-backed opposition led by Juan Guaido. Last week, authorities cut off water and electricity to the embassy. As they were on the verge of being raided, activists released a video statement vowing to continue the fight.
"We're not going to leave voluntarily. We came here to protect the embassy. We've been here for 34 days. We will stay longer if necessary. We hope that this still results in an agreement between Venezuela and the United States to protect this embassy from the fake government, the fake coup non-government that U.S. is pushing forward. So we're here. We're still resisting."
As Kevin Zeese of Popular Resistance. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our viewers and listeners across the country and around the world. The Pentagon has reportedly drawn up a plan to send as many as 120,000 troops to the Middle East if President Trump decides to take military action against Iran. The New York Times reports the Pentagon presented the proposal on Thursday after National Security Advisor John Bolton requested a revision to an earlier plan. Bolton has long advocated for attacking Iran. According to the Pentagon, far more than 120,000 troops would be needed if a ground invasion was ordered. This comes as tension continues to escalate between the United States and Iran. The United States recently deployed the Abraham Lincoln Carrier Strike Group and a bomber task force to the region, claiming there was a credible threat by Iranian regime forces. Meanwhile, Iran has announced it will stop complying with parts of the landmark 2015 nuclear deal and resume high-level enrichment of uranium within 60 days if other signatories of the deal do not take action to shield Iran's oil and banking sectors from U.S. sanctions. The U.S. has attempted to cut Iran off from the global economy, even though Iran has remained in compliance with the nuclear deal.
In another development from the region, four oil tankers, including two Saudi tankers, were damaged off the coast of the United Arab Emirates on Sunday. Saudi Arabia described it as a sabotage attack. Unnamed U.S. officials have been quoted in the media blaming Iran, but no evidence has been presented. Iran has described the incident as a conspiracy orchestrated by ill-wishers. On Monday, President Trump was asked about what happened.
"Mr. President, are you concerned about the attacks on oil tankers in the Middle East?"
We'll see what happens. It's going to be a bad problem for Iran if something happens, I can tell you that. They're not going to be happy. They are not going to be happy people. Okay? You can figure it out yourself. They know what I mean by it.
Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia is claiming drones carried out attacks on two Saudi oil pumping stations earlier today. A Houthi-run TV station in Yemen had earlier reportedly said the Houthis had carried out an attack inside Saudi Arabia. On Monday, the European Union urged the Trump administration to show maximum restraint following a meeting between U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and European Union diplomats in Brussels. Today, Pompeo's meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin to discuss Iran and other issues. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister, Javad Zarif, is in India today. Up until recently, India was the second largest importer of Iran's oil behind China. But India cut off sales after the Trump administration withdrew waivers allowing them to import Iranian oil. We're joined now by a former Iranian ambassador, Sayed Hussein Mousavian. He is a Middle East security and nuclear policy specialist at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. From 2003 to 2005, he served as spokesperson for Iran and its nuclear negotiations with the European Union. He's the author of The Iranian Nuclear Crisis, a memoir, and most recently, Iran and the United States, an insider's view on the failed past and the road to peace. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Ambassador Sayed Hussein Mousavian. It's great to have you with us. Very serious times, as the New York Times reports that the U.S. is preparing to send 120,000 troops to the region, to the area around Iran, is reportedly drawing up plans. Can you talk about the significance of this?
Yes, good morning. Actually, I expected such a situation after Ambassador John Bolton was nominated as National Security Advisor. I have written many op-eds articles during last year that it's going to happen, because even this morning, if you look at USA Today, two high-ranking American Congress members, Senator Murphy and Representative Himes, they have an op-ed saying that John Bolton and Pompeo are leading the U.S. into a war with Iran. Some days before, another two very high-ranking Congress members, Senator Durbin, they had the same op-ed saying that John Bolton is taking the U.S. to a war with Iran. Therefore, it is clear John Bolton wrote an op-ed at New York Times calling for attacking Iran, bombing Iran as the only option, as he said. He was allied with the terrorist group of Iranian terrorist group MEK. He gave lecture. He invited them to rule Iran. He called for regime change. Therefore, everyone knows what is the strategy and the mindset and the plan of Ambassador John Bolton. This is not a confidential issue. Second, the fact is the Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu for many years have been pushing the U.S. to attack Iran. He has huge influence at the White House. You remember when President Trump withdrew from Iranian nuclear deal, some days later, Bibi Netanyahu said, I asked him to leave the JCPOA, the Iranian nuclear deal. It was me who made him to depart from the deal. After President Trump designated Iranian army as a terrorist group, again, Bibi Netanyahu publicly said it was me who asked President Trump to designate Iranian army as a terrorist group. Therefore, this is very obvious, well known. The third issue is the fact that Bin Salman and Bin Zayed, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia and Emirate, they have been pushing the U.S. for many years to attack Iran. You remember Secretary of State John Kerry three times revealed that in any meeting he said we have we had with Saudis, Israelis, Emiratis, they were asking only to attack Iran, attack Iran, attack Iran. Therefore, the four B's team, John Bolton, Bibi Netanyahu, Bin Salman, and Bin Zayed, now they have excellent position at White House to push the U.S., the dream they have had for years and years and years, to drag the U.S. into a war with Iran. That's why I would say what the American Congress members have frequently warned, Iranians have warned, Europeans they have warned, is happening, unfortunately. That would be extremely dangerous for the U.S., for the region, for Iran, for international community. Because look at the situation in the Middle East today. What happened after the U.S. attacked Iraq? Who were encouraging the U.S. to attack Iran? Iraq. It was John Bolton. It was Bibi Netanyahu, who came to U.S. Congress member and publicly in front of hundreds of members of the Congress said, we have evidence that Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction and supporting Al-Qaeda. And they pushed President Bush to attack Iraq. And after that, everyone understood there was neither weapons of mass destruction nor evidence of any support of Saddam Hussein of Al-Qaeda. Therefore, everyone understand Iraq scenario is on the table exactly. Although, I mean, I should say personally, I believe President Trump really does not want war. He is, even he is not after regime change in Iran, but they are taking him exactly, gradually inching him to a war with Iran. And look at the situation, I mean, the consequences of U.S. attack on Afghanistan. After 17 years, over 50% of Afghanistan now is in the hand of Taliban, and the U.S. is crying to negotiate with Taliban for a face saving after thousands of Americans and tens of thousands of Afghanis, they have been killed. 5,000-6,000 of Americans, they were killed in Iraq.
Well, Ambassador,
look at the Yemen situation.
Ambassador, yes. Mousavian, given the scenario you've laid out of the context of everything that's happened in the past, how do you see this latest news of these four commercial ships that were sabotaged and Iran claiming that they believe a third country is behind these attacks? How do you see this as the buildup of a pretext to attacking Iran?
Exactly. This is exactly what I have said for many months. How they would drag President Trump to a war, this would be such an incident in the region. It is not new. I have said for many months, in many articles and interviews, malicious attempts by conspirators, conspiracy attempts, in order to blame, either to attack the U.S. facilities in the region or to kill some American soldiers in the region, or to attack American allies' facilities in the region. You just read last week some articles by Israeli papers saying that we have information that Iran is going to attack oil infrastructure of American allies in the region. This is the scenario. This is the conspiracy plan which they want to leave no option for President Trump unless to attack Iran.
Ambassador, we're going to break and then come back to this discussion and also figure out how this all started to spiral with President Trump pulling out of the deal that you helped to negotiate, the Iran nuclear deal. We're speaking with Ambassador Seyed Hossein Mousavian. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back with him at Princeton University in a moment.
رفتگان از دوکرانه زمان، آمدگان و رفتگان از دوکرانه زمان، سوی تو میدوند هان، سوی تو میدوند هان، ای تو همیش در میان، ای تو همیش در میان.
Existence Life by the Rumi Symphony Project. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We want to turn to President Trump last Thursday, who was speaking at an impromptu news conference. He said Iran's leadership should sit down and talk with him about giving up Tehran's nuclear program. Trump declined to answer a reporter's question about why he deployed the USS Abraham Lincoln carrier group to Iran over what was described as unspecified threats.
What did Iran do to prompt you to send an aircraft carrier to the region?
Well, they were threatening, and we have information. We have information that you don't want to know about. They were very threatening, and we just want to have we have to have great security for this country and for a lot of other places.
Is there a risk of military confrontation, sir?
I guess you could say that always, right? Isn't it? I mean, you know, always. I don't want to say no, but hopefully that won't happen. We have one of the most powerful ships in the world that's loaded up, and we don't want to have to do anything. What I'd like to see with Iran, I'd like to see them call me. We just don't want them to have nuclear weapons. Not too much to ask. And we would help put them back into great shape.
I'd like to see them call me, President Trump said. We are still with Princeton University Professor Ambassador Seyed Hossein Mousavian, Middle East Security and Nuclear Policy Specialist at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. Can you respond to what Trump said? And also, let's talk about the stranglehold of the sanctions that are that the U.S. is continuing to tighten against Iran, the effects that's having on the ground, Ambassador.
Yes, I think President Trump made a big mistake to depart from the nuclear deal. Practically, it was President Trump who left the negotiation table, because Iran and the big powers, the P5+1, they were negotiating at the level of foreign ministers and deputy ministers for years. And during even President Obama, you remember John Kerry and Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif, if not every day, they were weekly in touch, negotiating, meeting, emailing. When President Trump left the deal, practically he left the negotiation table. Therefore, he should be blamed for leaving the negotiation, not the Iranian side. And he is welcomed back again to the forum of P5+1 to return to the nuclear deal, to open dialogue and negotiation with Iran in with the other world powers if there is any other issue beyond the nuclear to negotiate. This is number one. Number two, there is well known by many nuclear scientists worldwide, even International Atomic Energy Agency, saying that the Iranian nuclear deal was and is the most comprehensive agreement during the history of non-proliferation. And Iran has accepted commitment for transparency measures and limitations on the nuclear program, which no other member of NPT, non-proliferation treaty, has ever accepted. Therefore, Iran has accepted the maximum level of transparency based on the reports of the IAEA and United Nations. Third, the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, which is the sole agency to judge about the nuclear program of the members, for 2 years, in 14 reports, has confirmed Iran has fully complied with the nuclear deal. Therefore, there has been zero failure on the Iranian side. The deal was approved by United Nations Security Council, United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231. The U.S. violated. It was the U.S. who violated the deal, departed, and now, and worse, which is really an unprecedented phenomenon during the history of international relations and United Nations is the fact that the United States is punishing the other member of United Nations for complying with the Resolution 2231 to supporting implementing the Iran nuclear deal. We have never had a UN Security Council member to punish the other members just because they are implementing the deal. You know, therefore, the U.S. is discrediting the highest level of international body on security and political, which is the United Nations Security Council.
Well, Ambassador,
because from now on, yes,
Ambassador, on that point specifically, President Trump did not only pull out, as you say, he is now trying to punish anyone who stays in the deal. Iran has waited patiently for a year for the other signatories to demonstrate that they're going to continue implementing it. So how do you place the announcement that they may begin enrichment again in the context of this year-long wait to see what the Europeans and the other signatories would do about the plan?
Exactly. See, it is actually for 2 years. From the day one, President Trump has started to impose new sanctions. Based on JCPOA, the U.S. and EU, they are committed not only to reintroduce the nuclear-related sanctions, but not to reimpose new sanctions. Therefore, the U.S. has violated, and he is punishing the other members for implementing the deal. Iran has been patient for 2 years implementing the deal with zero benefit. Now, Iran has decided on two measures, which is not a break of nuclear deal because the U.S. latest sanctions prevented the export of excessive amount of enriched uranium. Iran, based on the nuclear deal, Iran has accepted always to keep 300 kilogram and export the excessive amount to Russia of enriched uranium and 130 tons of heavy water and to export the excessive amount to Oman. Now, it is the U.S. has put sanctions on Iran not to export the heavy water, the excessive amounts to Oman, and not to export the excessive amount of enrichment to Russia. Therefore, Iran has no other option. Iran cannot practically export. Therefore, Iran would be forced to have excessive amount. Therefore, it is not a violation by the Iranian side. Iran has been forced by the U.S. not to export. However, Iran has warned the other P5 plus one members, that I have been waiting for 2 years for you. You have done zero. If you cannot implement the deal, I'm not going to implement the deal forever unilaterally. This is an international agreement. This is multilateral agreement. If the U.S. cannot comply, you should comply. If none of you are going to comply, I'm going to gradually depart from the deal. That's why now Europe, Russia, China, India, every country is blaming the U.S., not Iran.
UN official recently criticized the U.S. for imposing these unilateral sanctions on Iran, on Cuba and Venezuela that could lead to mass starvation, he said. UN Special Rapporteur Idris Jazari said, quote, real concerns and serious political differences between governments must never be resolved by precipitating economic and humanitarian disasters, making ordinary people pawns and hostages thereof. As we wrap up, the reality on the ground for the Iranian people right now and what this could mean also for the government when the people are suffering as much as has been described.
You are completely right. 80 million of Iranians are suffering from U.S. sanctions. And practically, the strategy of John Bolton is a war, a sanctioned war, economic war on Iranian nations in order to push them to bring a regime change within inside Iran, within Iran. Therefore, practically, they are punishing the Iranian nation. This is really a big humanitarian disaster because even Iranians, they cannot import medicine. They cannot import food. And when Foreign Minister Zarif was here some weeks ago, he just wanted to test the humanitarian humor of the U.S. side. He proposed for exchange of prisoners, regardless of whether the prisoners in the Iranian prisoners in the U.S. are guilty or not, or the U.S. prisoners in Iran, they are guilty or not. He proposed exchange of prisoners as a humanitarian gesture. And immediately White House declined. While we had such a humanitarian exchange during President Obama, but President Trump declined. Therefore, we understand now there is zero humanitarian goodwill from the U.S. side, and the policy is really economic war punishing the Iranian nation.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, Ambassador. Ambassador Seyed Hossein Mousavian is a Middle East security and nuclear policy specialist at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. He served as spokesperson for Iran and its nuclear negotiations with the European Union, author of The Iranian Nuclear Crisis, a memoir, and most recently, Iran and the United States, an insider's view on the failed past and the road to peace. Speaking to us from Princeton University, this is Democracy Now! When we come back, the award-winning playwright Eve Ensler, she has a new book out. It's called The Apology. Stay with us.
Valentina, yo puedo ser tu gran amiga, incluso tu compañera de vida. Yo puedo ser tu gran aliada, la que aconseja y la que apaña. Yo puedo ser cualquiera de todas, depende de cómo tú me apodas. Pero no voy a ser la que obedece, porque mi cuerpo me pertenece. Yo decido de mi tiempo, cómo quiero y dónde quiero. Independiente yo nací, independiente decidí. Yo no camino detrás de ti, yo camino de la para ti.
Tú no me vas a humillar, tú no me vas a gritar. Tú no me vas a someter, tú no me vas a golpear, tú no me vas a denigrar, tú no me vas a obligar, tú no me vas a silenciar, tú no me vas a callar. No sumisa ni obediente, mujer fuerte, insurgente, independiente y valiente, romper la cadena de lo indiferente. No pasiva ni oprimida, mujer linda, que das vida, emancipada en autonomía, activa, patriarca y alegría.
Patriarchy by Anna Tijoux. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
The Apology. That's the name of a groundbreaking new book by the world-renowned playwright and activist Eve Ensler that imagines what it would mean for a survivor of abuse to hear the words she's been waiting for her entire life. I'm sorry.
Eve Ensler's father sexually and physically abused her throughout her childhood, beginning when she was just 5 years old. His abuse caused immeasurable physical and emotional damage, but he never apologized for his behavior. So decades after the abuse and his death, Eve Ensler decided to write an apology for him. The result is a stunning new book in which Eve writes to herself from her father's perspective. In the book's introduction, she writes, quote, "I am done waiting. My father is long dead. He will never say the words to me. He will not make the apology. So it must be imagined, for it is in our imagination that we can dream across boundaries, deepen the narrative, and design alternative outcomes." Eve Ensler is the well-known author of The Vagina Monologues. Over 20 years ago, in 1998, she launched V-Day, an international movement to stop violence against women and girls. She's dedicated her new book to every woman still waiting for an apology. Eve Ensler, welcome back to Democracy
Now. Good morning. Very happy to be here on the publication date.
Well, it is really an honor to be here as you launch this book. Eve, talk about what prompted you to do this extremely unusual book act. I mean, what you must have gone through to write this.
Well, I think there were several factors that kind of inspired me to do this. One was having worked in the movement and violence against women for 21 years and looking at the recent iteration of Me Too. How many women have broken the silence? How many women have told their stories? How many women have called men out? We see a few men losing their jobs, white men in particular, getting them back fairly quickly. We see a couple people maybe going to prison, some losing status. But I was thinking in all this time, particularly in this recent, when have we heard a man who's been accused come forward and make a thorough, deep, authentic accounting and apology for his deeds? And not only could I not think of one example, but I went back in thousands of years of patriarchy and think, when have I ever read that happen? When has a man ever come forward and an apology where you detail an account of the harms you have done and the actions you have taken, where you go inside the feelings, the heart, the body of your victim to try to experience what she felt, where you take full accountability for your actions and you evidence through that a process of self-interrogation, which means you could not possibly do that act again. We've seen a few men come forward who have spoken out about being called out, but they seem to be more kind of self-piteous rants about the loss of jobs or the loss of face. And then I thought to myself, well, I've been waiting 60 years for an apology from my father who died 31 years ago. Maybe I could write the apology I need to hear, to write the words that I need in order to get free. And possibly that could be a blueprint for what we could begin in our movement as the next stage of reckoning. Because we can only call out men. Like punishment is such a weird thing, right? It curtails behavior momentarily, but it doesn't necessarily educate or transform people so that they will not repeat that behavior again. We have to move to the next level where we create a pathway and we create an impetus, and men are catalyzed to begin to make deep and thorough accountings and look at themselves and say, what about my childhood brought me here? What about toxic, racist patriarchy brought me here? What in my own history do I have to go back and re-examine and look at? And how do I make amends so that my victim or the person I have harmed can be released from this story and move on? That was the basic premise.
Well, it's a really powerful book. But what you have to do in order to achieve that goal is to actually, in essence, do it an autobiography of your own father. Go into his own development, his own history, what he was feeling. And I'm wondering, it must have been emotionally draining to have to write this.
I mean, I think for many of us, and I just want to say this book is an offering, it's not a prescription. I think there are many people who have no desire for an apology and don't want to hear an apology, and I was certainly that way for many, many years of my life. It's not a have to. It's like, if this works for you, do it. But I will say something. You know, for so many years, my father was this monolithic monster to me, right? And yet, I was in a kind of paradigmic vice with him, right? I was still victim to his perpetrator. Even my whole life has been framed by that paradigm, right? With all my work, my writing has been framed. So my refusal to really know my father kept me in that paradigm because he remained monolithic monster to my victim. The process of entering my father, or should I say letting my father enter me, because I do feel to a large degree he was very present through the writing of this book. I feel like I went into a strange trance state for 4 months where I felt he was present with me and talking to me. I don't even know some of the language that he wrote in this book. It's not my words. It's not my voice. Learning about my father's story, where he came from, the steps in his own childhood, in his own patriarchal upbringing, in his own abusive upbringing that led him to become the person, were profoundly healing for me. Because I think most survivors are caught in the why, right? Whether you have survived racial abuse or gender abuse, or you're caught in why? Why would someone beat me up because of the color of my skin? Why would my own father? Why would my own father try to kill his daughter? Why? Why? And doing this book and doing, I began to unpack the why. It was like, oh, this happened to my father. And that isn't justification. It's explanation. And I think there's a big difference between justification and explanation. I think when you deepen, Emma Goldman once said, we can't forgive people until we understand people. And I think that gave me a pathway to begin to say, oh, now that didn't mean it wasn't incredibly painful to go into my father and learn about my father and feel his pain, because for so long I didn't want to.
Talk about what happened to you. You talk about your father as Shadow Man. Explain what happened.
Well, I think for my father, he was brought up in that era. He was a child that was born long after the last child in the family, like 15 years. He was going to be that golden boy who was going to take the family to a whole new direction and raise their economic status. And he was adored. But adoration is a very damaging thing. It doesn't allow you to be a human being. You can't be messed up. You can't make mistakes. You can't be tender. You can't cry. You can't be lost. So my father, all those feelings that he had, he just kept pushing underground and pushing underground and pushing underground. And then he kind of created this very charming veneer, which he adapted from the movies and Cary Grant and all those kind of contemporary movie stars at that time. So all that dark, disturbing, the stuff he was not allowing him to accept got pushed under. And I think at my birth, the kind of birth of his tender baby daughter evokes so much tenderness in my father and so much vulnerability in my father that he had no capacity to deal with that because he had smothered his own. He had smothered his own heart. He didn't have any way to go, oh my God. And so what he did is what the Shadow Man would do. He went for it. He had it. He raped it. He grabbed it. He took it. He diminished it. He conquered it. He had dominion over it rather than just letting himself be at the mercy of it. I was listening to Arundhati Roy the other night talk about leaving bauxite in the mountains. Can you just look at the mountains? Can you just leave the bauxite in the mountains? And I was thinking, it's no different than women's bodies or a little girl's body. Can you just honor the tenderness? Can you just look at the tenderness and appreciate the tenderness? And the answer is, if you don't have a capacity to be vulnerable, if you don't have a capacity to stand in your own tenderness, no, you have to seize it and dominate it and exploit it and take it. And sex is the way, and rape is the way to avoid that tenderness. So I think that began the journey.
So this started when you were like 5 years old.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how did you recall these memories?
It was like I said, I've known pieces of my story. I've never allowed myself to really put it all down, to just go, here's what happened. And I think in writing the book, because I was writing it from my father's point of view, I suddenly had memories that I had never had before, because he was the carrier of the memories. Do you know what I mean? And I'll tell you something interesting that I learned, and I want to say this to other survivors. We carry our perpetrator inside us. We carry them. If someone enters your body, if someone beats you, if someone harasses you, if someone rapes you, they enter you. And particularly family members, because we live with them. We know their movements. We know their footsteps. We know what the sound of a cocktail sounds like after four. We know what that can do to us if they're going to beat us, if they're going to harm us. So I'd been in dialogue with my father for many, many years, whether it was conscious or not inside me. And what I realized in the course of writing this book is that we can actually turn the perpetrator inside us in another direction. I actually could change my father inside me from a monster to an apologist, from a monolithic creature to a broken, real, human, tender human being.
And the impact on the rest of your family and the failure of others around you, especially in terms of your mother, to protect you?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question. Last night, somebody was asking at the Y event, you know, they were talking about women, white women who voted for Trump, and are there parallels?
And you were talking about the 92nd Street Y, where you were interviewed by Glenn Close.
Right. And James Naughton performed the piece so beautifully. And I was thinking, you know, my mother was a woman who had grown up very poor from Missouri. She did not have money. She met my father, who was this charming, right, you know, exterior New Yorker. And it was her road out. It was her economic road out. And by the time my father began doing what he was doing, she already had two children, right? She had no money. She had no formal education. What was
your brother and sister?
Yeah, my mother had no formal education. So where was she going with her children? And I also think at that time, whether my mother knew it consciously, unconsciously, no one talked about any of this at that moment. I don't think my mother felt agency enough in her life to protect her children. And at one point, she actually said to me, "I sacrificed you. I sacrificed you."
Did she say this when you were a child or as a woman?
As an adult, when I confronted her about what happened. Several months after I talked to her, she said, "I sacrificed you. You were what I had to give up to keep the way of life that we had." And I think sometimes fear, you know, terror. My father was terrifying. I think in some ways my mother was the fourth child. Do you know what I mean? We were all under the tyranny of his bullying, of his anger, of his violent outbreaks, of sort of like the state of mind that we're in America today.
You were the keynote speaker at your graduation. What was your dad's response?
Oh, that was a horrible moment. Yes, I gave the keynote speech on feminism and racial justice. I was 22 years old. I walked outside to light a cigarette because I was completely... And my father was there, and he lit my cigarette. This was after I spoke to thousands of people. And he had a cigarette. He stood there silently, never mentioned the speech, never said a word about the speech. Time passed. Eventually, he said, reached in his pocket, he handed me a check for $1,000. He shook my hand and he said, "Have a good life." It was as if someone had taken a fist and punched it into the center of my being and knocked me out. And I have to tell you, it set me on a very bad path for many years. You know, drugs, alcohol. It was like the final crushing moment. You know, I think even if a person abuses you and incests you and beats you, it's still your father. You still want their approval. You still want their love. So for me, it was like, here I had done this. And it was like, boom.
So he raped you and physically assaulted you constantly throughout your childhood and teen years. When did he stop?
He stopped when I came home from college. I think I was in my first or second year, and I said I wanted to be a writer, and he said, "No, you're going to be a lawyer or an accountant." And I said, "No, I'm not." And he picked up a chair and he started to smash it over my head. And it was the first time in my life I stood up and I said, "If you ever touch me again, if you ever touch me again, you will never see me for the rest of your life." And I walked out the door. And that was the first time my mother in all those years stood up for me. And she followed me up the road and she said, "I told your father that I'll leave him." And I said, "It's a little late, you know, 10 years too late, but okay."
And during your adult years before his death, was there any kind of communication or?
We had a few attempts. When I got sober, he was really unhappy because he didn't like the idea. It was very threatening to his sobriety. As a matter of fact, he mixed me a drink. We had occasional times when there'd be these strange, very failing attempts to connect. And he didn't contact me before he died. He didn't contact me at all. As a matter of fact, a week before he died, he came out of his stupor. He died of lung cancer. And he said to my mother, "I don't want even my will. And I want you to know, if she ever tells you anything, she's a liar." And my mother said to me, it was that made her know I was telling the truth. Because why would he have said that out of his stupor?
What is the anatomy of the ingredients for an effective apology?
Thank you for asking that. I think so deeply about what is an apology. And I think, first of all, it's a humbling. It's making yourself vulnerable. It's an equalizer. It's going into the detailed accounting of what you had done, because the liberation is in the details. It can't be broad. It's not like an I'm sorry. I did this. I did this. I did this. It's feeling what your perpetrator must have been feeling as you were doing it. It's letting yourself open to the heartbreak of that, to the sorrow of that. It's doing self-evaluation and self-interrogation, where you look at what brought you to do that, what in your childhood, what in the culture, what in your religion, what in your family, what in any part of your life drove you to do that behavior. And then one of the things I really learned is, like, we live in a culture of diabolical amnesia. We deny what happens in our family. We deny what happens in our history from the beginning of indigenous people through slavery. An apology is a remembering. What occurred did occur. And so by doing that, we are actually reattaching the pieces of our own histories into a healing kind of cloth. And I think when you make an authentic apology, there's an alchemy that occurs. When you hear someone who has gone through the steps I've just outlined, something in your body, in your psychology, in your spirit releases, because that person has gone thoroughly and deeply and authentically into themselves to become vulnerable to you, to become equal to you, to become connected to you again. And I think, in a way, we need to now move in our movement to, as Tony Porter at A Call to Men brilliantly said, says, we've called men out. Now we need to call them in. Now we need to call them in.
I'm wondering, talking about half-hearted apologies, we've all heard the reports of Joe Biden attempting to semi-apologize to Anita Hill about the way he treated her during the Clarence Thomas hearings. Your reaction to that, and is that a perfect example of how not to apologize?
It's a perfect example. And I'm really proud that I have Anita Hill's quote on my book, because when I wrote this book, I was thinking, like, who are the people who are owed the biggest apology? And certainly Anita. But I think what Anita Hill was saying, and I think it's so critical, is there's accountability. What has your harm done, not just to Anita Hill? What she was saying is, what is your harm done to millions of women who were impacted by that decision for Anita Hill? The delegitimization of Anita Hill, the humiliation of Anita Hill, the putting Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court. What kind of decisions has he made over these years that have impacted? And I think what she was saying is, we want accountability. We want thoroughness. We want you to look at what are the impact of your, to some degree, collusion with Clarence Thomas at that time. Reading Jay Meyer's article, she talked about how he was talking to them throughout that whole process. So I think that is an excellent example. And I think, you know, my father says to me in the book this really brilliant thing. He said, when he said it to me, I was shocked, because I really feel like he spoke to me. He said, to be an apologist is to be a traitor to men. Because there is a male code. We don't apologize, which is why I think we haven't heard one in 16,000 years of patriarchy. That once you, the one apology happens, once a man owns that he knows what he was doing was wrong, the whole story begins to crumble.
We just have 30 seconds, Eve Ensler. A message to women, a message to anyone still waiting for an apology.
I think to men, the time is now. To find a clergy, a person, you know, a counselor, start to work on your apology. It's a process. It's a journey. It's a practice. It takes time. And to women who can't get an apology, write yourself one from your perpetrator. Work with somebody to support it. Do a thorough, thorough letter from the person who harmed you to yourself. The impact on me was profound. I feel free in a way I have never felt in my life. And I think this process, we just did this process at City of Joy in the Congo with the survivors who wrote letters from their perpetrators, and the outcome was astounding.
Eve Ensler, we're going to do part two and post it online at democracynow.org. Eve Ensler, award-winning playwright, author of The Vagina Monologues. Her new book is called The Apology. A very happy birthday to Erin Dooley. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.